Competition. It's something that seems so inherent in our culture, at least here in the United States, whether that's in professional sports, teen spelling bees, reality TV, Survivor, The Bachelor, Project Runway, you take your pick. It manifests in jobs and striving for success, or at its most basic level, survival. So where does this drive come from? What exactly is the psychology behind it? And when does it cross the line and become unhealthy? Batter Up. This is Central Standard. I'm Alana Gordon. And at bat is our resident psychologist, Dr. Bruce Lease, who's here with us to delve into the fascinating realm of competition. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Lease.
Oh, thank you. I love that introduction. That covers it all.
So first, okay, I want to define the rules of the game, so to speak, in this discussion. What exactly do you mean by competition?
Competition is a contest between individuals or groups. It can be a contest for prestige, for recognition, for wealth, for group and social status. It can be a competition for a lot of things. It certainly involves social comparison. So when we go outside the realm of athletes and teams and all that stuff, it can just be fashion and things like that. It's looking at yourself and comparing yourself to other people. It's considered by a lot of people to be the opposite of cooperation. And it's when people strive for goals that can't necessarily be shared. It's like only one person can be the best looking person. Only one person can be the greatest cyclist in the world and so forth.
So it has to do with this comparison. But yet at the same time, it's kind of fit into this idea of winning and losing.
Winning and losing is a huge part of it. I like to look at all the scientific literature before I do any of these with you. And so there's actually a book, and the title of it is Winning. And it's a very, very good book that questions winning. It's called actually Winning: Reflections on an American Obsession by Francesco Duino. So I'd recommend it to anyone. But yes, winning and losing is what we're talking about when we talk about competition.
And yet at the same time, it seems like there's something so inherent about it. And I wonder about, when we look at our most basic level, or when you look at the most basic essence of beyond human, if you get into the science of it, how does psychology view this, and how do you view this as something that's just, it's who we are?
Yeah, I can talk about the psychology, but also, since you're talking about it being basically human, evolutionary biologists view intra-species competition as the driving force behind adaptation and ultimately evolution. So that's how basic the drive to compete is. And from a psychological standpoint, competition enables us to differentiate ourselves from other people. It enables us to think, here's who I am. I am not as good as somebody at this. I'm better than somebody at that. And that's not to say that it's good or bad. It's just what we naturally do as human beings to separate ourselves and to understand who we are, our own identity.
And I want to get to, in a little bit, that idea of it's not good or bad, but sometimes there's ways that it can, manifest that maybe less good or less bad in some ways. But when you talk about competition as, part of our culture, I also wonder about what you see as, is that being the same everywhere?
Well, you mean like internationally around the world? We Americans here in the United States, we value competition more than most, in fact, more than all countries internationally. And that's supported by a huge survey done by the World Values Survey, which is online, worldvaluesurvey.org. Every 5 or 6 years, they do a survey of every country, and they ask them questions about the legitimacy of this and that. And one of them is, how important or how good is competition? As Americans, we really value it more so than any other country.
Why do you think that is?
I think that our country was founded on the premise that all people are created equal. And I think that concept that we're all equal makes people uneasy. I don't think people like to think of themselves as exactly equal to anyone. So here we are in the new world, back in the beginning, trying to figure out who we are. And we have freedom, and we have a free economy system, and we don't all want to be the same. We think of being the same as an ordinary phenomenon. So I think we got off and running in our democracy by trying to differentiate ourselves as being successful and courageous and adventurous and all that stuff.
So at the same time, you know, in another, you know, place or culture, the idea of how you view your own success, or often it's maybe more of that collaborative notion or that way of like we as a whole, maybe that's part of what you're saying we find in differentiating in the U.S., let's say, than another place. And are there other places that vary from that?
Yeah. In this World Values Survey, we are viewed as more into competition than most countries, but we're often compared to Denmark, which is among the lowest, the countries that have the least amount of value that they place on competition. And if you have ever been to Denmark, it is a much different country than here. Here there's a lot of focus on making partner in a firm, whether you're, you know, whether you're the A team or the B team. You know, of course, what we do to children by putting them in competitive activities all the time. We are a culture truly obsessed with competition. And again, that's not a good or bad thing. It drives some good things, but it certainly drives some bad things.
So you're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Alana Gordon. Our guest is Bruce Lease, professor of psychology at KU Med Center. And we're discussing competition. And I'm really curious, do you view yourself as a competitive person? Do you think it makes you better, or does it overwhelm your life? Join us by calling 816-235-2888. Again, that's 816-235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. So in terms of this kind of obsessive competitive nature that you find in the United States, I mean, in kind of broadly speaking, in what way is that kind of laying, you talked about kind of being founded on this equality, and in some ways really, you know, good can come of that. Where do you see this kind of dynamic playing out in terms of what results from that competition, what it brings?
Well, where I see it playing out, just the contexts themselves first, sports, business, economics, education, politics, careers, you name it, society, in nature. I mean, it plays out everywhere. And I think that a lot of us Americans are constantly feeling insecure that we don't measure up. That's certainly potentially the downside of competition, when we don't see ourselves as measuring up. So,
and so when you don't see yourself as measuring up, is this kind of feed into you? I mean, in terms of the work that you do, is there this place where there's this kind of achievement, and like, what is the result of that achievement, or as opposed to always feeling like you're not quite achieving?
Well, that's the unhealthy side. The unhealthy side of competition is that it can demotivate people, or it can discourage them from participating in activities that they may otherwise enjoy. It can also lead, when people feel inadequate and they can't compete and they can't take the number one spot, it leads some people to be angry and hostile and envious. Envy is a pretty common emotion when people feel like they are not measuring up to standards that other people are meeting. One of the really interesting things you find when you look at the competition literature in education is that kids who are in highly competitive educational environments are more likely to cheat than kids who are in less competitive educational environments. And even more interesting is the kids who have learned, particularly from their parents, to be internally motivated, to want to go to school because, you know, they love to learn. And there are kids like that who love to learn. They love to read. They love to do math. Those kids, even in competitive environments, are less likely to cheat. The kids who are taught to focus on grades and to please the teacher and to please their parents, they're more likely to cheat. So I guess the moral of that story is that it's okay to be in a competitive environment. In fact, it can be very healthy to be in a competitive environment, as long as you retain the kind of the core belief that you're there to learn, to gain mastery, to better yourself, versus just performing or doing better than the next guy.
Do you find in terms of the psychological research, I mean, do people respond differently to competition?
Oh, yeah. people who you can almost put them into categories. People who are very successful early on start to over-focus on performance, and they pay a lot of attention to how they're doing. People who, and I said you can put them into categories, people who are less successful, for example, in underserved areas of our country, who they have a sort of learned helplessness. They think to themselves perpetually, I didn't make it on this test. I didn't make it on that test. I give up. I'm not going to amount to anything. So people differentially respond to competition based on prior experiences and what they tell themselves and what they believe about themselves. So to the extent that parents – and that's the category of how well you do. You do well, you want to do more. You do poorly, you want to do less. As I said earlier, another way to think about people and how they relate to competition is whether or not they are taught to love learning and to love the idea of mastering things versus being taught you got to win. Winning isn't the – how does it go? Winning isn't the it isn't the most important thing. It's the only thing.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thinking can be pretty damaging and destructive. One of the things that I've seen in my career is professional athletes or really highly successful people who then, for one reason or another, are very, very successful in a competitive world where, for one reason or another, they need to leave that competitive world. You know, professional athletes are a good example. And they don't know what to do with themselves. I mean, people in the military who have achieved great status and they're officers and they have real meaning in their lives because they've competed well and they get to the top of the food chain, so to speak. And then when they're out of it, they've lost their identity. They don't know who they are. The competition was everything to them, and now they're in a world where the rules are different.
And so then when you think about, I'm really curious about what you talked about in terms of we respond to what kind of how we do and how that then plays into how we value our own self-worth or, hey, you know, I did well in this realm. I did well, you know, in the military, and I'm finding these successes and building on those successes. But, I mean, are there differences in how people literally respond to that competitive edge? Like, does it motivate some people more? Does it bring out more? Or does, on the other hand, does it really discourage other people more?
That's a really good question. I hadn't thought of it that way. I think the way I would answer that question is that if you enter into an activity, and I'm thinking now because of my personal interests, if you enter into an activity like sailing, for example, there's some really inherent pleasure from engaging in the activity. And if you develop the skill set to do it well, I think you'll always enjoy doing it. Once you start competing and find that you're not at the head of the pack, I have a lot of experience with not being at the head of the pack in sailing, in racing. I've lost interest in racing, but I have not lost interest in the activity. So if I were an attorney where billable hours were everything, in a firm where I survived only by billable hours, if I were in that environment but I love the practice of law, I might leave that environment, that competitive law firm, and go into practice for myself where I can just kind of relax and, you know, and make enough, see enough people to pay the bills. So how do people react to competition? It depends on whether you love what you're doing or not, whether you are immersed in it. It depends on how you view yourself, whether you think you are a capable, competent person. A lot of variables will determine. It's really important to think about children here because we learn all of this stuff I'm talking about now when we are young. And when parents send their kids or when their kids come home and say, I want to play soccer, and the parents say, fine, and they send them off to soccer or soccer camp or whatever, it's really important to watch how kids respond to that challenge, starting a new competitive activity. And it's important that parents really infuse children with very positive ideas about, again, learning and mastery rather than just performance and winning.
What about kind of the role of incentives or the role of, you know, awards? I mean, you talked about how in some ways when you think of the healthy realm of competition, it has to do with really loving what you're doing. And that is kind of the achievement in and of itself. And then when you think about kind of this award of self-worth, of being number one, there's that. What about kind of these exterior motivations too, or how does that play into, obviously, you know, you talked about in the business realm with money, but even in terms of when you think about the competitions that we see in sports and everything, how does that kind of reward endpoint play into it?
Daniel Pink has written a book that is extraordinary. It's called Drive. And in that book, he reviews all of the literature, the research and everything about internal versus external motivators. And he reviews one study where they took a bunch of people that normally give blood, and they offered to pay people for it. They gave an extrinsic reward to people who would then give blood. They said, we'll pay you if you'll do it an extra time. And fewer people gave blood when you introduced, because they saw giving blood as a pro-social, benevolent thing to do for the world. And as soon as an extrinsic motivator, money, was introduced, signing up for giving blood fell off in the same group. And then what they did was they offered another group that they'd give them, they'd take money and they'd give it to a charity for people to give blood. So again, an external motivator, but it was given to a charity, and people decided, you know, this is great, and more people signed up to give blood. So they felt they got more pro-social bang for their buck. But when to answer the question about extrinsic motivators, as soon as you introduce an extrinsic motivator to something that's an extrinsic motivator is something that's intrinsically rewarding, there's a good chance it'll trail off. People will no longer see it as doing it for the value of doing it. So how many people have said to you, how many times have you heard, never take your hobby and turn it into a career? Don't ever get paid for something you love to do. It's that concept. If competition is encouraged by giving you money or something like that, there's a chance you'll burn out on it.
Well, Shayla writes in an email, competition has driven me to great success. However, I sometimes feel like a victim to competition. When I fail, I think I'm not good enough. And I think that kind of plays into this idea of how much that's internally, how we value or perceive how we're valued, and that self-worth and social status.
Yeah. Once a person reaches a certain height, you know, the old expression, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. Once a person has become, I'll use the word, addicted to success via competition, it's going to be very painful to pull that success away from them. They'll go through withdrawal, and it'll start to mean too much. There's really the potential for winning to mean too much to a person.
And so then, when we think about competition in terms of here in the United States or whatnot, and we talked a little bit, you know, about there are other places, for example, Denmark, where maybe that dynamic isn't as competitive. What about when you think about nature?
Like the birds and the bees and stuff like that. The tallest trees win the competition. The ones that are shaded by the tall ones have the potential to die. I think that's a form of competition, and it's inevitable, and we can't get away from it here on Earth.
Mm-hmm. And so in terms of, you talked about at an early age with kids, and it's kind of how we train our kids and kind of being mindful of how we respond to that. I'm really fascinated with this idea of the culture of competition, especially now amongst kids. And on the one hand, it seems like there's a hugely competitive environment. I mean, in that competition, I mean, how do you see that playing out in terms of childhood development? And you talked a little bit earlier about how, you know, finding that kind of internal motivation and the types of educational settings that we have. What do you see kind of dominating, for example, our culture and in the, you know, the work that you do?
It's like politically correct to say, I don't care how well my child does in this sport as long as they enjoy themselves. And it's politically correct to say, you know, they don't have to get A's. I don't beat my children if they don't get A's. But once once kids start to get involved in competitive activities and once they start to get going on doing something well, spelling bees, chess, you name it, soccer, once kids start to do well in something, it begins a momentum that not only parents pick up on, that momentum, but also teachers do and their friends do. And so, children are some competition, and especially for some kids, is terrific. A kid who likes that kind of stimulation, perhaps a kid who's taught simultaneously that it's okay to be competitive and it's okay to lose and you better enjoy it. That's the most important thing. Kids like that can really thrive on competition. Kids being told, go do the spelling bee. If you do great, we'll be there cheering you on. If you don't do great, we'll still be there cheering you on. That kind of mentality helps kids to adapt in an inevitably competitive culture. In this region that we live in, right here in Kansas City, we have schools ranging from absolutely not competitive at all in certain school districts to some of the private schools, which are spectacularly competitive. The only thing that kids talk about at some point in time is, applying to colleges. Which college did you get in? Is it an Ivy school? So forth and so on. It's rampant, that kind of competition, in some schools and almost absent in others. I have worked very closely with, I would say, numerous young people who were pushed to compete academically and then they feel horrible in college because they're still not doing what they really want to do. There hasn't been enough of what do you love? What floats your boat? What is intrinsically rewarding to you? So a lot of repairs have to be done when kids are in that kind of a competitive environment and their needs for learning who they are not met.
And at the same time, do you see that competition, that structure, that discipline can lead to – how do you see that people responding? And maybe how do you differentiate between that kind of individual dynamic and then kind of the broader outcomes or developments in terms of a skill or in terms of achieving?
Well, I have seen the competitive environment at some private schools here to lead to kids that are so smart and well-rounded that it's just awesome. I mean, they know a lot about a lot of things, way more than I knew when I was their age, and that's just awesome. It's just so cool. And their parents did something right along the way. They encouraged them to gain balance in their lives or whatever. And then I've seen the other thing happen. And so that other thing being that, kids feel like they don't fit anywhere. They just don't. So
then what the other end of competition in terms of when you talk about that realm of kind of achieving that point, what leads to a person to cheat?
Well, cheating is a fascinating area. Cheating can cross so many different boundaries. Kids cheat when they're afraid to fail. Athletes cheat when they're afraid to fail. People in, the banking crisis, the Great Recession, there was a lot of cheating that went on. People knowing that they were doing the wrong thing and they did it anyway. What leads people to cheat? An obsession with winning is what leads people to cheat.
An obsession, and how does, pressure build into that too?
Well, our value system, what we place in our minds as most important, the things we think are, extraordinary, the most important stuff. If we feel like we can do the most important stuff in this world and do it pretty well, we won't feel any great pressure. If we feel like we're going to come up short, if we think it's important, if the goal is important and we think I'm not going to make it, then we feel an immense pressure and fear of being a nobody.
So what are some examples that you can think of where, is it just people who are, have you been surprised? Have you seen situations where people that you may not have thought would cheat, wind up cheating?
I did not expect Bill Clinton. I did not expect Bill Clinton to get in trouble in his presidency. You know, he you know, it's not a political statement. I just his presidency was going along pretty well. He wasn't getting in any trouble. And all of a sudden it was clearly discovered that he had not told people the truth. That's a form of cheating. So that was a big shocker. Certainly not one that was up close and personal to me. But I think I'm – oh, when I heard the story about that athlete who talked about his girlfriend who was dying. I mean, that's not cheating at your sport. It's cheating people by pretending you're somebody you're not. So in order to gain some kind of recognition or attention or something like that. Yeah. So the big, big, big public crashes are the ones that really grab me.
Well, our guest is Bruce Leese, our resident psychologist here in Central Standard, joining us for a conversation about competition. Kansas City, have you ever cheated in pursuit of a goal or prize? Did that cheating ever prompt you to stop that behavior? Or do you find that it's difficult to turn off that competitive drive? Join the conversation at 816-235-2888. Again, that's 235-2888. Or post your comments to Facebook or on Twitter. Our handle is KCURCST. We're going to take a break right now. We'll return with our exploration of competition, and we'll take some of your calls. And also, please be sure to stay with us at 11 for a live debate with the two candidates for mayor of Kansas City, Kansas, on Up to Date. Central Standard returns in just a moment. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Alana Gordon. Our guest this morning is Bruce Leese, our resident psychologist here on Central Standard, joining us for a conversation about competition. And one of the things that we want to hear from you about is how have you managed competition in your own lives, but what about in your children? When do you think your child's becoming too competitive, and how do you or do you at all temper that competitive drive? Or how do you see that among your kids' friends? Please give us a call at 816-235-2888 or post your comments to Facebook or on Twitter. Our handle is KCURCST. Bruce Leese, thanks again for joining us on Central Standard.
Always my pleasure.
So when we've talked a lot about, you know, this competitive nature and kind of how growing up and what you've seen in Kansas City, and you referenced a little bit about academics and the perils of that. And I'm really interested in you talking a little bit more about how, you know, that may or may not lead to cheating and when that gets set up.
Back in the day, when I was in graduate school, we had a lot of programs that we were developing for what we called deliberate psychological education. It was an all-out effort to come up with curricula for schools that helped kids to understand their worlds from psychological standpoints. And so whether you were in kindergarten or 12th grade, a senior in high school, we came up with curricula that were relevant, you know, getting, you know, why people, some people get along and some people don't, how to treat your neighbor, things that would teach kids emotional intelligence. And interestingly, it was met with a lot of resistance among parents who felt that, you know, schools shouldn't teach their kids values. But the effort back then, and I still think it was potentially of great value, the effort was to teach kids to be happy and to adapt well in life. And we don't have curricula in that, in academia, in elementary school, in middle school, in high school. We don't have curricula that say, you know, you just came from the hardest biology exam in your of your life. How do you guys feel and how are you coping with it? Do you want to, here's what you do to de-stress, stuff like that. There's nothing countering in the curriculum. There's nothing really countering the intense competitive demand that's placed on kids. I could see in one of those curricula something on cheating, you know, teaching kids why people cheat and why they shouldn't cheat. And, you know, as soon as you start talking words like character, all of a sudden people believe that that's so value laden that it shouldn't be taught in our schools. Mm. We don't want you to teach our kids about character. Is what we heard at that time. But Developing character simultaneously with developing intellectual stamina, I think, is a really potentially valuable thing. So when I see all this competition in schools, I think it's great because that's that push to make kids, to make us people learn more and think more and all that. I think it's very positive, but not without that balance.
And so when you talk about kind of this type of education and you think about maybe that character building or thinking about happiness, I mean, how do you teach something around happiness?
Oh, I'll tell you. I do believe that reliable, consistent happiness, or what I prefer to think of as joy, because happiness in my mind is a momentary phenomenon, and joy is really a way of approaching life. I think the way you teach people to be joyful is by mastering the things they love. It's the same goal as the goal involved in competition. In competition, we want, for example, in the education system, we want kids to compete for high grades so that they learn a lot. Well, there are very, very effective ways of teaching kids to value mastery without even thinking about competition. Just the beauty of – and so you asked about happiness. Mastery is the best path to happiness. There's a book entitled Be So Good They Can't Ignore You by Cal Newport, and he talks about just the joy of being really good at something. And there's a researcher, a psychology researcher, whose last name is Csikszentmihalyi. It's impossible to spell, so I won't try. And he discovered the concept of flow. Flow is when we're in our happiest state, when we're not worried about what the competition is doing, when you go out to the garage to work on your project, or you go into the kitchen to work on your project, or the basement, or the library, and hours go by and you're so immersed in it. That's a joyful, happy state that produces great mastery outcomes, and there's no competition involved. That's what makes it flow.
So you're talking about really like the antithesis of competition is happiness in some ways?
You know what? Happiness is like cocaine. I mean, competition is like the happiness from winning a competition is like cocaine or any other addictive drug. And that's an area that I study also. That's why the metaphor is so handy to me. Hint, hint, not because I use it or anything like that. So the rush that one gets from winning in a competition is short-lived. And you have to wake up the next day and figure out a way to get the next hit, the way to get the next bump, the way to get the next, you know, success. So competition isn't the antithesis of happiness, but the happiness that one derives from winning at a competition is such a high and so short-lived that one craves the next win unless one is able to walk away and say, well, that was enough. I did well, but that rarely happens.
Well, so then when can winning be bad, or are there situations then when losing can be a good thing?
Losing can be a good thing when people lose gracefully and they respect and appreciate the experience they've just been through despite the loss, and they feel good for their opponent because somebody had to win. I have valued all of the losses in my life because they somehow trigger me kind of reflecting on not only what did I do wrong that caused me to lose, but how much do I really value this activity? If I don't do something well, I want to go back and look at it and say, did I not do well because it wasn't really me, because I was trying to do something that wasn't really me.
Do you find that in terms of childhood development, that competition in and of itself can help build character? Because there is that certain competitive, when you're put into that court, you know, when you're put into the arena.
Yeah, competition not only builds character, good or bad, it does build character. It also does build a certain kind of drive to get better. So, again, competition can build character in that it pushes the right people, the intrinsically motivated people, to really look at what enabled them to win or to lose. And it can also build character where people will do anything to win.
Well, Mason from Blue Springs is on the line. He called 816-235-2888. Feel free to join the discussion as well. Mason, thanks for joining Central Standard.
Thank you for taking the call.
Yeah. How has competition played out in your life?
Well, I think I've only recently come into, I guess, the intellectual mindset in order to assess it. I'm 26 now, but definitely competition has governed a lot of my life, and it definitely started when I was young, being in athletics and a lot of the things I did for fun, like games and other things like that, were all based in competition. And I think that I learned incorrectly, as I would call it, just because the emphasis did become, could I win? You know, it did motivate, it has made me good at a lot of things, but not the best. And I think, as you were saying, especially in our culture today, being the best seems to be all important. And, you know, I'm not the best, and I realize that in the, you know, various activities that I enjoy. But it does limit what, I guess, how much of it I do enjoy, because I'm not the best.
Since you've realized that, how has that changed, you know, and Bruce, I'd be curious about you weighing in on this too, how that changes kind of your mentality of it as you take part in sports or something like that?
Sounds like you had a big mind shift, a positive shift in your thinking to think that you don't have to win to enjoy what you're doing.
Yeah, I've definitely been trying to do that. But I think in some ways it has almost evolved or devolved into something worse, in that I almost feel a pressure now, like a clock is ticking, that I have to do something big. I have to be, you know, great, or I have to be the best at something, or life, or my life, more specifically, is not as valuable. And I think that that's just because, you know, maybe people grappling with the concept of trying to be great at anything go through this. But, you know, I'm not great at, honestly, I'm not great at anything. I'm not the greatest. But, you know, I guess you just have to come to grips with that at some point.
You know, it's interesting. Your comments are really insightful. And I had a whole bunch of thoughts. One of them is that to take oneself or mostly, if not completely, out of the competitive world, one thing that's really awesome to do is to volunteer. And by engaging in volunteer activity, various volunteer activities, a person can really figure out what they love to do. And, you know, there's no money in it. Really, at the most sincere level, when you really just do it to volunteer, there's no prestige or status. You're just there to say, I want to help. I want to do something that matters. And I'm saying this because I think just about everything I've ever done in my life that I've done well, I've started by doing for free. And I didn't worry about being the greatest. It was just to do it, whether it was volunteering at Salvation Army or volunteering to help kids learn a sport or something like that. And another thing I want to say, I had a flash earlier of something that we hadn't gotten to talk about. A lot of times there's competition within families, spouses that compete with each other. And sometimes in relationships, boyfriends, girlfriends, husbands, wives compete with each other. And that can really be pretty toxic. It really drains the life out of a relationship. But the reason why I say that is that one thing we can all do great, the one thing we can all be best at in the whole world, nobody can be better than us at, is loving another human being well. You can be the best person in somebody's life and really make a difference. And without a doubt, if you do that, there are people, they will look at you and say, there's nobody who does more for me than you. So, you know, at a time when you're thinking, I don't do anything great, that's something that everybody can do great when they commit themselves to it, is to caring well for others, which is not a competitive act. One does not care well for others when one is competing with them, typically.
Mason, thanks for your call. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Alana Gordon. Our guest is Bruce Lease, professor of psychology at KU Med Center, and we're discussing competition. Hen writes on Twitter, "My daughter becomes almost unhinged while watching cheating in a movie. She wants to leave the room. Is that healthy?"
Cheating, like what kind of cheating? Are we talking about like extramarital cheating or?
I would imagine that I'm going to interpret this, but what I wonder about is seeing people cheat in terms of competitions.
Huh. Well, I think it's good to not like cheating. It's really respectable. It's interesting because we don't get excited about watching like a master, a chess master playing against a five-year-old in chess. And we don't get excited about competitions where one party is obviously going to destroy another party, like a professional football team playing against a high school football team. We don't get excited about that because it's not exciting. It's kind of a drag. Cheating introduces that kind of unfairness factor that takes the life out of a competition. Once we know that's why so many recent cheaters in professional sports have been at the center of media attention, because you know an assumption about a competitive activity is that all players are on level ground and nobody's cheating. So I can understand why. We don't know how old she is, her daughter, but it's good that she doesn't like cheating.
One of the things I wonder about, okay, we're in, you know, the midst of March Madness. Well, it's April now, and the Royals are playing today, and there's a certain affinity. I mean, is it healthy or not healthy when you think about that team mentality? You know, when you think about competition, you're differentiating yourself from something else, and yet you're also identifying you're part of something as a fan.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
as
yeah.
a team member.
There's a whole psychology of being a spectator. You know, the world of everyday work is characterized by very limited opportunities for us to express ourselves. But once you have the role of a fan, whether it's football or whatever you're a fan of, chess, bowling, in that role, there's a passion and a meaning that emanates from the whole act of rooting. And it's kind of like you have a whole new identity in life. You can step out of your mundane world. And you all of a sudden are, you know, you're somebody with a, you know, with dreams and passions that may or may not be fulfilled today as you watch. But it's a fascinating world, the world of the spectator.
And what about then on the court? One of the things I wonder about is this dynamic of in competition, choking, how we respond psychologically under pressure.
Right. Not the kind that somebody's hands are around somebody's neck.
You know, I can imagine being, you know, playing basketball, being fouled, shooting those free throws, nail them every time in practice. But then come game time, maybe not the same story or maybe the opposite.
Well, choking, let's define it. It is some kind of stress or pressure or tension that somehow causes a person to perform less well than they would if they weren't choking. So, there are these wonderful treatments for psychological treatments for performance anxiety. Performance anxiety is when, you know, you're the world's greatest pianist, but when you get up there, you know, your hands are sweating and you want to just cry and fall on the floor. So that's a form of choking. So performance anxiety and choking, let's just say they're the same thing. What happens when people fail to perform as well as they could, what happens is they are overly concerned about themselves. To play piano beautifully, to shoot goals brilliantly, to get up and give a speech wonderfully, to do those things, your mind can't be distracted by whether or not you will do well. So the treatment for any kind of choking or anxiety or performance anxiety, the treatment is to get people to get their minds the heck off of whether they're doing well or not. You can't be thinking, will I make this shot? You cannot be thinking, my team will hate my guts if we lose this. They'll blame the whole thing on me. Choking generally occurs when people are distracted from the task. the mastery. And so that's the way to go. If you're afraid of doing something and you feel all shaky and sweaty, stop thinking about whether you're going to be shaky and sweaty.
Has there been research or how has that been looked into when I think about some of the most successful athletes, let's say, and that dynamic is part of the success in some ways not being competitive?
You know, it's interesting because I read something about Michael Jordan and his mentality. His mentality, I think he made something like 60% of all of his foul shots, something like that. And his mentality was, I make every shot, period. That was what he thought. I do make every shot. I don't miss any shots. That's the way he thought. He just never let his mind drift to the competition itself or to losing. And that was among the things that made him great.
I feel like we're getting into very Zen moments here. Jimmy's calling from St. Joseph. Thanks for calling into Central Standard.
Thank you. I called because, as I hear you talk about this, I've thought about this before. I'm a medical student, and so I have some perspective on competition. But it seems to me that with our, you know, concentrating more and more in competition, we start to judge success by whatever parameter we use. You know, you did the best on the test or something like that. And what it seems to me is happening is there are a lot of people that may have specific skills that let them do very well on the test that doesn't necessarily communicate with any skill, you know, in the real world. For instance, medical students, even law students, have to do this. You have to take a test so that you can be, you know, gauged, see if you're ready for medical school. And the test, while it has a lot of information that we've learned, a lot of people say doing well on that test only proves that you can do well on that test.
So thank you so much for your call. So when you think about competition and you think about how we train competitively to build these skills.
Jimmy said that he was a medical student, and I've been teaching at KU Medical Center for 30 years and have gotten to watch the effects of both competition and pressure right there in front of me. And I was talking to a resident just the other day that said it well when he said that, you know, when he got to medical school, he was really idealistic and excited about being a doctor and taking care of people. And the competition was just really discouraging. It changed his focus from I want to take care of people to I need to get through this to survive. We can't understate the kind of pressure that comes with an academic program like medicine and its potential effects, negative and also positive, on people.
You are professor in family medicine. How do you see the competitive edge working out in terms of developing that knowledge and that tool set to be doctors?
Well, what I find is that the less in the different specialties, the more people are encouraged to, you know, to take care of people, and the less they are attacked for missing a point or for, I'm trying to say it totally in lay terms, when you're in rounds, you're supposed to report on your patient. And in some specialties, if you do anything wrong or with some attending doctors, you get sort of slaughtered emotionally. And that really detracts from, I think, your humanity. And I think that shows up when it's time for you to take care of patients. So I would encourage everybody who teaches in an academic environment that's that rigorous to remember that we're training human beings to take care of human beings. And that's the most important thing.
And Steve is calling in from Overland Park. Steve, thanks for calling in to Central Standard.
Thanks so much. I'm a classical musician, and I was just hearing your conversation about performance anxiety, and I wondered if the doctor could comment on the use of beta blockers, which are very, very, very popular, you know, way of classical musicians getting through auditions, and even, you know, I have the big solo coming up in the next concert or whatever, that kind of thing, that they know they're not going to make it through without the prescription drugs.
Yeah, and actually, that's been going on for many, many decades, actually, for several decades. You know, medication is not a bad thing. And beta blockers in particular, I'm not a physician. I'm a psychologist. I don't prescribe at all. But beta blockers, I can tell you this, are not like addictive drugs. And they don't take over your whole body and mind. And that's why they're chosen for competition. But the problem with any external adjustment that you can make to feel good in a situation is that you might develop the belief that I need it, and I need it again, and I need it again, and I need it again. So it's the psychological hook that's dangerous.
Well, Dr. Bruce Leese has been with us as a guest today, as he often is, as our resident psychologist on Central Standard, talking about competition. Thank you for joining us.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you so much.
You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of kcur.org. Please tune in tomorrow for an important discussion about child abuse. Up to Date is next with a debate between the two candidates running for mayor of Kansas City, Kansas, live from the Kansas City, Kansas main library. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. I'm Alana Gordon, and this is Central Standard.